This week on Pop of Culture, we create from a place of joy.
A lot of the work that we see, if it's about trauma, right, the thing that we're heading towards is sort of this like deep catharsis where the release just leaves us feeling down.
And we come together through comedy at the Common Market.
I'm Muslim. If you never had a Muslim friend before, let me be your first Muslim friend. I want the warm and gooeys, and I want those warm and gooeys to extend into everyday life.
Coming up, Pop of Culture on IPR is made possible in part by the Indiana Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations, and by sustaining members of IPR. Become a member today at indianapublicradio.org.
From Indiana Public Radio, this is Pop of Culture. I'm Jen Blackmer.
And I'm Michelle Kinsey. We are back from vacation. It's so great to see you, Jen.
You too, Michelle.
And we are jumping out of the pool and diving right into the arts and culture conversation. Later this hour, we'll speak to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me panelist Nagin Farsad about using comedy to bridge the divisions in our country.
But first, we continue with our ongoing series of conversations between the coasts. And we're here today with playwright, dramaturg, and educator T.J. Young. And T.J., we're super happy that you could come and be with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. Now, first of all, I know the folks in our audience want to know what the heck a dramaturg is. So I'm going to ask you that question. T.J., what the heck is a dramaturg?
Sure. Yeah. So I like to think of dramaturg by breaking up the root of the word, like drama and turg. Turg being someone who works with, like a metallurge works with metal, right? A dramaturg is someone who works with dramatic text to either provide research, wise eyes on the development of a piece, provide context, either historical or social, just so that way you can either move from page to stage, right? Helping a new play find its voice and find what it's trying to say, so that way it's ready to be produced, or taking pieces that are already in the canon or within the literary space and providing them with contemporary context. That way the actors know what they're doing, the director feels supported, designers know which direction they want to go. I like to say that we are not the encyclopedias, but we know which encyclopedia to open.
That's great. I think I make a joke a lot of times when I'm working on a project that I would love to have my personal dramaturg, right? Somebody who kind of walks around with me and gives me that encyclopedic information about all kinds of things, right?
Yeah. And, you know, even in my playwriting, there's a couple dramaturgs that I actually have that relationship with. That's really nice to be able to just text them. And I'm like, hey, I have this idea. And I was going down this rabbit hole. And then they say, oh, but have you thought about this part? And it kind of blows open in a really nice way. It's one of my favorite relationships to have in the American theater.
Absolutely. And I agree entirely. So let's go back in time then for a little bit. And again, playwright, dramaturg, educator. Let's start with how you got started in your work, because I know you're originally from Texas. So tell me about your story. Tell me your story.
Yeah, so I was lucky enough to go to a creative arts elementary school, P.H. Green Creative Arts Elementary School in Friendswood, Texas.
So there are creative arts elementary schools? I knew that there were high schools and obviously colleges, but I had no idea there was an elementary school.
Yeah, it was the only one of its kind in the district. And it wasn't like something that you had to like apply to go to. If you just lived within the zone, you just got to go, which was great. So we did.
That's amazing.
You know, we did music, we did dance, we did not like intense dance, it was like junior jazzercise, you know, but we had a theater program where I was in all the plays, and we actually started a small little children's theater troupe called the Curtain Kids, and we'd go to like teachers' conferences and do things about bullying or, you know, self-esteem. And so, you know, I did theater all through middle school and high school. And actually after high school, I was like, I think I'm done with theater. A lot of it was because I attended a predominantly white institution, and there were times when I would audition for roles because I was an actor, and they were like, we'd really like to put you in this role, but you know, we need you for Cassius Biggs and Fire in the Hole from the Kentucky Cycle.
Oh,
you
sure.
know, and as a 16-year-old, I'm like, why?
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I was at the University of Houston for my first semester as a psychology major that I was like, let me just try to write a play. Let me just see. It can't be that hard to write shows that I would want to be in as an actor.
Oh, okay. So that was how you got into it then. You were thinking about stories that you specifically could tell as an actor.
100%, right? And then I wrote a show called The Ballad of Barry Lawson, which was an absolute ripoff of Death of a Salesman. And it's awful. And but you
don't
know,
don't ask me about my first play. It's in a box somewhere, and I look at it when I want to feel better about myself.
Yeah, I don't. That TJ was efficient. He accomplished too much in 27 pages. You know what I mean?
Wow.
But after I finished it, I was like, I know this isn't great, but there's something about it that I want to keep doing. So that's when I just kept writing and writing. And eventually I actually transferred from University of Houston to the University of Texas at San Antonio, which is a weird thing because they don't have a theater program, right? They have a really fantastic English creative writing program. And in my head, I was like, I want to learn more about literature and poetry and the basics of other types of writing so I can then apply it to something that I grew up in, which was mm-hmm. theater. You know?
Yeah, yeah. So you went into a creative writing program hoping to improve your theater work. That's great.
100%. Yeah. And then I hooked up with a student theater group called the Bargain Basement Players, and they called themselves that because they didn't have enough money for rights to shows. So they wrote all the shows wrote my first one act comedy. Yeah, from there, it just became a bug where I was like, I need to be writing, I need to be creating, and I need to find a way to make this my living.
Right. So what was it like doing that in Texas? Were the audiences responsive? Did you find, you know, did you sort of, or maybe a better question is, as you were sort of figuring this out and you got the bug, as you say, did you begin to think about what kinds of stories you specifically wanted to tell? Like what makes a TJ Young play a TJ Young play?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that initially, me being in Texas and understanding the role of majority-minority populations specifically within that state mm-hmm. And the stories that were being told on stage, which were kind of based in trauma and struggle and, you know, not coming from a place of joy. We're talking early 2000s, right, where this idea of joy-based theater wasn't predominant, right?
Yeah.
I've really focused on the beginning of my career of writing plays that the best actor could step into. So that way, individuals who were normally cast just as a minority character could then play the lead, right? And their race or their gender identity wasn't the highlight of their role.
Right.
I have since then, I like to say that my plays fall into two camps. Either identity is central to what I'm trying to explore, or it's not. And if it's not, it's like wide open. But if it mm-hmm. is, it's very specific. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Because I was like, I contain multitudes. Sometimes I just want to be the hero that walks down the street and does the thing. And no one really thinks about, sure, the factors of identity and race and gender and sexuality all play a role in that and how we perceive that. But to have a character to have an actor be able to just bring whatever they want to a character, I think is really freeing.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. So I love this idea that we contain multitudes. And obviously, I mean, that comes from Whitman, and it's a kind of a driving force of my life as well, because human beings are contradictions, right? How we feel about one thing one day can change and evolve and grow based on things that we've learned. And so I want to talk about that a little bit, about this notion of writing from a place of joy, right? Because mm-hmm. theater is oftentimes about conflict. It is about trauma often, because those are moments of significance in our lives, right? And as storytellers, we obviously want to tell stories that are about significant moments, significant things. And so when you say writing from a place of joy, what does that mean for you?
Yeah, it's not void of conflict, right? It is this idea of what is that release at the end. And I think a lot of the work that we see, if it's about trauma, right, the thing that we're heading towards is sort of this like deep catharsis where the release just leaves us feeling down.
Right.
As opposed to there's conflict. And at the end of the release, there feels like there's a lifting of something. There is a pulling up of something. We leave lighter than what we entered the space in.
Right. I like to think of it as different. I mean, we leave different, right? So that the process of the catharsis or the learning is already, I think, starting to manifest itself in some change and maturity, if you will, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, in all my plays, I'm like, I want to make people cry. Sure. But like, how
that's okay. It's a goal for a lot of us, actually.
Yeah. But like, how can I make them cry happy tears?
Yeah, right.
How can I get them to a place where they say, oh, life is beautiful. That's the joy that I want to say. And it's, I've the older I've gotten, and I'm 36, and so this might sound cynical, but I feel like joy is always tainted with this, oh, but it was birthed from me being down, right?
Right.
Like, I can't feel happiness until I recognize, oh, I was sad 2 days ago, you know? Right.
Yeah.
So I think exploring that sort of emotional spectrum within it and ending in a place that is a lift is kind of my goal in those situations.
So your contact, we're talking today. You're in Pittsburgh, yeah?
Yes.
And so talk about your journey from San Antonio, Texas to Pittsburgh.
Yeah. So I came to Pittsburgh right after grad school. My partner at the time told me that he got a job in Pittsburgh while I was at a writer's retreat, and he was like, we move in 2 weeks. So I was like, okay,
oh, wow. Cool.
I'm no longer with him. That's not the point.
Yeah.
But yeah, when I got here, within a month of me getting here, I had already connected with a local theater called City Theater, and I was a teaching artist with them. And so I went to middle schools and high schools and taught playwriting. Right? Specifically one acts. And from there, it really became about ingratiating myself into the landscape. So I sent emails out to every theater company saying, hey, I'm new in town. I'd just love to talk to you about what your theater company does. Some of them were like, hey, we don't really have anyone on staff who can take the time to have a coffee with you. But they introduced me to a wonderful playwright, Tammy Ryan, who is here in Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. And Tammy Ryan was like, here are the people you should know. Here are the people you should contact. Here are the other playwrights in town. Here are some directors. Here are some organizations that you should look at. And that was really like the launching off point for my theatrical career here. And I will say that even just sending out those emails was probably the best decision I have made as an artist, because it immediately connected me with people and not organizations, and immediately started introducing me to the type of art that people like and the type of art that people create here. So I could see, you know, where can I fit in? Where can I offer my services, and where can I actually pour my support in as well?
That's great. And one of the things that makes me think about too, TJ, is that over the course of these multiple conversations we've been having on the show, one theme that continually reemerges over and over again is this idea of community. And we think that art can be a very solitary endeavor, especially writing, where you're kind of in a room doing the thing by yourself, but that ultimately it is about connecting with other human beings, whether that's in the audience or in your case, whether that's establishing a network in a new location, right? And how often it can be life-changing and career-changing to send some emails or to sit down and have coffee with somebody you've never met before, right? And there's this just beautiful sense of community, I think, that emerges among artists regardless of where you find yourself.
Yeah, I mean, like, our relationship, like, you know, I've known you for seven or 8 years now,
mm-hmm.
and it started because you responded to one of my plays, and I asked you, I said, when I rewrite this play, can I send it to you? And you said yes,
and it started and it like was, this. And it's great, so yeah.
And it started this relationship of simply asking, like, hey, you, because I noticed that you gave me feedback because you believed in it, and you saw the potential in it. And I was like, that's someone I want to connect with. And that's someone I should be connected with. Right.
Right. Right. Yes. Yeah, exactly. So you established a community in Pittsburgh, and then what happened?
Yeah, and then it really became about what did we need as Pittsburgh artists? And the thing that we found that we need is just a way to get our voice out there. And there are a couple of initiatives in the city that do that. There's one thing called the Momentum Festival at City Theater, where it is we had a section called In Their Own Voices, where it was playwrights reading a 7 to 10 page section of their play. They're reading all the characters, they're reading all the stage directions, right? But it really is the art, like it's the purest connection between the playwright and the audience, right?
Right. Yeah.
That was a really great program. Then I was like, I latched on to that. Me and another playwright, Maura V. Harris, we are both the co-reps for the Dramatists Guild, and we use that opportunity to create reading opportunities. We had something called At Rise, where it was just the first scenes of plays. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Where the playwrights would read for each other and we would present just those first scenes to kind of whet people's appetites. And then there was there's a playwrights collective at the Pittsburgh Public Theater that we actually talked to the artistic director, Mariah C. Kaminsky. And we said, we want a place where monthly we can come, a group of us can come together, share pages, get feedback with artists that we trust. And we started this hashtag here a couple years ago called hashtag Pittsburgh Writes Plays, because it's this reminder that there are artists here doing work that's homegrown, that is varied in style and theme, but the connection is that there are artists living and actively doing work. And, you know, thriving off that work here in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, and it's built in the place, right? It's not right. As though you're, you know, taking a story from someplace else or some other, you know, kind of older play that's been around for a while. It's new and it's responding to the community in which it was made.
Yeah, there's this beautiful theater company here called Pittsburgh Playwrights, run by Mark Clayton Southers, and he has a stipulation that anything that's on his stage, the individual has to have had a connection to Pittsburgh for longer than 3 years, I think, or be an artist that's actively working here, right? So all of his work, a majority of his work is new. You know, there's often... I don't want to say scarcity, because that's not the mindset I like to operate from, but there's often competition for, you know, the actual production of these works, but that's something that's advantageous of the American theater in general.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But everyone here supports each other in the development in the of not only the work, but also the artist.
Right. Now, when I think of Pittsburgh, and I've never been, but that's something we're going to fix soon, right?
Yes,
when you think of Pittsburgh, you think of this industrial city, right? And Pittsburgh is obviously much bigger than where I live in Muncie. But talk to me a little bit about the collision between sort of the industry of Pittsburgh and its history and then art, right? Because art, again... And this is the stereotype, I guess, is that it's, you know, of the elite, and it's the sort of, you know, the heightened thing to do. But it doesn't have to be, right? Art is a reflection of who we are, right? So how does that collision of art and industry happen in Pittsburgh?
Yeah, Pittsburgh is this weird mashup of sweat and rust and artistic expression. So there will be a lot of use of old cinder block buildings that not only become breweries, but, you know, the brewery will have an open mic and they'll have a fantastic concert. There was once where I helped with an album release that took place in a church that had been remade into a ropes course, right?
Wow.
It's about the reuse of space and the reuse of the things that we have around us. We have a lot of site-specific and outside theater here in Pittsburgh. The Blast Furnace has been used here for two productions. One of them was Hamlet. The other one was King Lear, right? Where people are actually inside the courtyard of this place that used to make coke for steel, you know?
Hamlet in a blast furnace. That's about the coolest thing I think I've heard of in a long time.
Yeah, so like it is this, it's this mashing up of aesthetics, and Pittsburgh has a very grunge is not the right word, but like post-industrial sort of grit to it, where there's the sheen and the shine of the new, but then if you go down the street, there's still remnants of the industry that was there before, and instead of hiding it, it's often embraced in the way that we make art.
Yeah, yeah. So what would you, what, I guess if you were the city of Pittsburgh talking to the city of Muncie, what advice mm-hmm. would you give the city of Muncie?
Ooh, that's a great question. You know, lean into what makes you, you. Also understand that the residents that like live inside of you have stories to tell that are just as impactful as the people who live in New York or California or Chicago, or I have this saying that I'm like, if I see one more musical that takes place in New York, I'm going to go crazy. In the same way that I'm like, if I see one more show that takes place in LA, I'm going to go crazy. I understand the fascination with those places, but I'm like, that never felt like where the heartbeat of America is, you know?
Right. Yeah.
Those places are absolutely, they're people who have authentic and real and impactful stories and relationships within those locations, 100%. But the vast majority of individuals live literally in between those places, and their stories are just as important. And those markets that are presented, that I think that all of us theater artists grow up thinking that that's where we have to be. That's where we
right.
have to chase.
Right. And I've been told that through my entire career, right? That I can't be a serious artist if I don't, you know, choose to sacrifice everything like a house and a backyard and a dog and go move to a big city. Go move to, New York, especially.
I like
especially.
Being able to drive an hour one way and be like, I'm within hiking distance and still come home to my nice suburban place where I can walk down the street to, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah. And one, I think there are many of us who do. And unfortunately, I think that doesn't fit within the narrative that we've been told about what it means to make art.
Well, I'm going to blow some people's minds. They have to realize that the largest industry for theater in the United States is educational theater.
Right.
There are more, there are more places in this country doing theater that are attached to schools, that are attached to community centers, that are attached to programs, than there are Broadway houses or big Lort houses. As an artist, I find that those plays, while I absolutely want my play to be seen on a bigger stage, I understand that if I have a play that goes up in Iowa, that's just as important as a play that goes up in New York, as a play that goes up in Houston, right? Because yeah. those people need stories too. And if I'm feeling some type of way about a situation, so is someone else in Wisconsin, you know?
Yeah, right. And the act of theater itself is educational, right? Because you're sharing a story, it creates empathy, and you are learning as an audience member about something that you're not familiar with, let's say, or looking at that from the perspective of somebody new.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important, especially because theater is here to explain life to the living, right? And as theater artists, us sharing our stories and our point of view just helps broaden the perspective of someone else. And just like I go to the theater to be refilled, I'm also going to have my boundaries pushed, and I shouldn't have to pay $700 between flight, room, board, and a ticket to have that happen.
Yeah, and you're going to have your boundaries pushed, but to also do it in a way that hopefully will provoke joy.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Absolutely.
And understanding and connection. And all the reasons we get into this in the first place.
Yes, and you can do that anywhere, which is great.
So TJ, this has been an absolute pleasure today. Thanks for taking time out to have a conversation with us.
Thank you so much for having me. And I hope I was able to provide some sort of insight for our listeners.
Some sort of insight, I think, is an understatement. TJ Young is a playwright and dramaturg based in Pittsburgh, where he is also an associate professor of dramaturgy at Carnegie Mellon University. You're listening to Pop of Culture. I'm Jen Blackmer.
And I'm Michelle Kinsey. Just before Pop of Culture took a little summer vacation, we were in the audience for the Great American Punchline Tour Stop, where comedians answered the question, is the solution to America's polarization problem jokes? We spoke to some of the people making it happen. Okay, Katie, so tell me, what are we doing here?
So this is the Muncie, Indiana stop for the Great American Punchline Comedy Tour, produced by Good Laugh, which is a program of the Center for Media and Social Impact, based in Washington, D.C. at American University. And really, we created this comedy show based on our own research and practice and belief that comedy is one of the special cultural forces that actually manages to bring all different kinds of people together. When we do a lot of serious work about comedy and human rights, or just comedy and like really basic civil dialogue, and a lot of times, I think it's like a gotcha question that people want to ask, like, what is it about comedy? How do you do, can we take comedy seriously? And we say, of all the cultural art forms at our disposal, comedy doesn't, because comedy is in all of us and we all have like a funny uncle or grandma or crazy funny dad or whatever, you know, we can really actually all connect on that level. And the idea that we only make rational, deliberative decisions through sort of news sources alone is not, we humans are emotional creatures. And when we laugh together, I like to say that there are a lot of art forms that give us empathy. And I think comedy gives us solidarity. Comedy is not just saying, I feel really bad for that person and I'm kind of glad I'm not them. Comedy says, wow, you're different from me, but we're kind of the same in our basic human flaws. And that solidarity to me feels more powerful for coming together and solving our shared problems than just empathy, right? I mean, by the way, love empathy, don't hate empathy. But solidarity says we're actually the same.
So the ultimate question, I think, why Muncie, Indiana?
Well, Muncie, Indiana is one of the great original American cities. It was a titan of manufacturing. It was a really important place in American history. And often places like Muncie, Indiana are not visited as much, right? And so the Great American Punchline Tour is actually going right through the middle of the country into all kinds of communities that are like Muncie, Indiana. And we like the history of General Motors being here and the many people in the community sort of reinventing what Muncie is going to be for the future. And I'm not going to lie, we also like knowing that Garfield was from Muncie, because obviously we discovered that. So that's pretty fun.
Yeah. And David Letterman went to school right down the street, Ball State University.
I forgot about that. Oh my God, that's amazing. Well, one of the greats. Yeah. I mean, also, why not Muncie, right?
Exactly. We are Middletown, USA,
yeah,
after all.
Everyone is so friendly here. It feels like this is a place that knows how to play, knows how to have a good time. And we've been really moved, especially being here at the Muncie Common Market. This is such an incredible community place where people show up to take care of one another. And that really is, you know, our show is funny and sometimes it's raunchy because it is comedy and we don't believe in censoring comedians. But also it's the spirit of bringing people together in a place where all kinds of community people come together. Like today we spent the day here and we met community health workers, the local social workers, the local professor who created the business plan for the urban farm, and Mike who runs the place, who's a musician. It's just an incredible spot. And, you know, we all live, all the comedians are from different places around the country, from 7 different states. And we, the producers, are all from different places. And what we've been talking about all day is how much we wish we had a place like this in our places where we live. Because this is a little bit non-existent in many urban places that sometimes we hold up as being the United States, but not really, right? It's really all of us.
Hi, everybody. I'm going to be your host for this evening. My name is Nagin Farsad. Hello.
Oh my gosh, what a pleasure.
Hi,
I'm so sweaty. I'm sorry, Nagin.
No, that's okay.
Yeah, just
nice to meet you.
I am thrilled to meet you.
Nagin, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
How's it going?
Very well, thank you. Okay, so first of all, I understand that you are serving as MC.
Correct.
For this this evening. Talk to me about kind of your approach, the whole
your whole approach to emceeing an event such as this?
Oh, you know, the MC is in many ways the most important role. No, it's I love emceeing because my whole feeling about like a show is that this is a party. Everyone is invited. I want everyone to have a good time. I want it to feel fast. I want it to feel like when you finish the show, you're like, oh my God, I want more show. Like I want the audience to have all those feelings, and I feel like, you know, an MC gets to kind of like set the pace, you know, get a little, you know, Usain Bolt into the show, you know what I mean? And that's what I try to do. I'm not saying I do it every time, but that's what I try to do.
Goals. There are goals
yeah, exactly,
involved.
Exactly.
I understand you just started this round in Milwaukee, so you've already done a show in Milwaukee. Tell me how that went. How did it feel? What was the response? What was the feedback?
Well, this is a really unique show because we basically rounded up like the most like diverse group of comedians, and by diverse I mean we all represent like totally weird, quirky subsets of the American population. We are like literally the thing that makes this you know, we're the like the Keep America Bazaar faction of America, right? Like the what you love about how strange America can be, like that is what I feel like this collection of comedians represents. And and so I feel like, you know, we had this really great show in Milwaukee. We're gearing up for another one here in Muncie, Indiana. And I think people like to see this kind of like country sort of reflected back at them in the form of comedians. So it's a good, I think it's a good time. You hear, you know, between the six of us, like, you know, I grew up in California. You know, there are people from New Jersey. There are people from Alabama. There are people from Georgia. Like it is an extremely mixed, geographically mixed group of people that have just like a wide range of stories from the urban to the rural, to the like at anything in between. And so I you don't often see that on shows, and I think that's what's kind of really special about it.
I'm assuming there wasn't arm twisting involved to get you to participate in this, but why, personally, why did you feel like this was something you wanted to do?
My whole feeling is like, you know, I have performed all over the country as a stand-up comedian. I think 48 states, no, 49 states. I've also performed in Hawaii and Alaska. I'm looking at you. And and I feel like, you know, there's this big, you know, discourse among everywhere you go that America's divided, that Americans don't like each other. But my experience as a comedian that's literally performed everywhere is that is not at all the case. Whenever I go somewhere, I am embraced. People are really delightful. They're really nice. They like to laugh. They like to tell me what food to buy in their hometown. You know what I mean? And so I kind of want to, I want to be a part of like changing the discourse that we're so divided. We are actually not so divided. Like I don't think we should let these like political wedge issues make us believe that, you know, we're not. And so being able to be a part of a comedy tour like this, it's really trying to bring people together is what, yeah, like you're absolutely right. There was no arm twisting involved at all. Like I believe in it really strongly.
When it's all said and done tonight and you say goodnight to everybody, what do you want people to walk away with?
I mean, I just want people to kind of have that warm and fuzzy feeling about their neighbors. You know what I mean? Like we're all in this together. And I want people to feel like they had a good time, they had a laugh, they heard some perspectives maybe they hadn't heard before. I'm Muslim. If you never had a Muslim friend before, let me be your first Muslim friend. You know, yeah, I want the warm and gooeys, and I want those warm and gooeys to extend into everyday life.
I'm already feeling the warm and gooeys. Thank you so much, Nagin. Really appreciate
it. Thank you so much.
The Great American Punchline Tour rolled through the Common Market in Muncie on July 8th. The event was recorded, and producers hope to share it with a larger audience in the future.
Every week on the show, we ask an artist, what are you working on?
Today, we're chatting with a clay artist. Joining me in the studio is Torin Scott.
Torin, tell us, what are you working on?
Currently, I'm working on a series of ceramic robots. I'm planning to have a show in September, the first Thursday of September over at Gordy's, which is kind of full circle. I worked there before I left for the Navy. And then this new series is clay robots that will be on display September 6th. And they are ceramic pieces that I've thrown on the wheel and then connected into these forms.
Yeah. So what inspired this current show that you're working on, the robots?
Yeah. So the idea of still being functional after damage is kind of what these robots represent. So when I was in the service, I was in an accident and I ended up getting retired from the Navy because of it. And, you know, they had to put me back together. Mm-hmm. And so these robots kind of represent that journey that I took, with my knee and my arm and my face to kind of build me back up. I don't know about the $1 million man, but so these robots kind of represent that path I took recovering from that injury, those injuries.
Yeah. How has that kind of helped you recover? Do you find it to be cathartic when you're working on like this particular show with such a personal meaning, a personal impact?
That connection, yeah. So, and the neat thing too for me was after my injuries, it took me a long time to have full function of my hands again, and the wheel actually helped facilitate that. So even before I started working on these robots, it was the clay that kind of brought my strength back in my hands and allowed me to kind of recover from that, you know. And then now, working on them 10 years later, mm-hmm. Has kind of is reflected in all the little bits and bobs that kind of pulled them together is kind of how I look at it, me still being a functional human.
Yeah. And an artist. And that had to be extremely emotional not to be able to do what you loved, which was get your hands in the clay, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It was a struggle. You know, I was on my back for 9 months.
Wow. What is it about clay that keeps you coming back? How does it make you feel? What is it, you know, what does it do for you that you feel like, you said you've done other things in your life, but you know, you keep coming back to clay? What is it about working with it that brings you joy?
Well, I think that there's a couple different aspects of it that I find intriguing. Mm-hmm. One of them just being the idea that it's just dirt. It's just something that we've dug out of the ground and that we've been making marks on for thousands and thousands of years. But the responsiveness, so every time I put a tool to it, that interaction is permanent. So we're still digging stuff out of the ground from 20,000 years ago that people made, and so that idea that you're creating something, be it functional, you know, a coffee mug or, you know, sculpture or anything of the in-between area, every time you react, the clay also gives you a reaction. And then the other part of it too is that part of it you have to just let happen. So some of it is you got to pray to the kiln gods to have your piece come out okay.
that is so true.
Yeah.
What have been some of the most memorable pieces for you to create?
This is always a great question. For me, it's always the next one. I mean, it's the one that I'm working on currently. The next thing. So everything's additive in craftsmanship, I think, where you learn a little bit of a lesson with each piece. And so my favorite's always going to be the one that's in my brain still that I haven't figured out how to make yet. So I hope that answers the question.
Yeah,
but
it sure does. It sure does. And I would say, you know, that when you said, you know, what's in my brain and how am I going to make that happen? Before we started chatting and being recorded, we were talking about your robot pieces. And our producer, Luke, looked at the picture and said, wait a minute, that's clay? Because they, you know, if you just look at it, it looks like a robot, metal. I mean, you really would probably have to touch it to make sure that it is not metal, because the detail that you have in these clay forms is unbelievable and very realistic and fun. And talk a little bit about, like you said, kind of the trial and error of getting those to look so robot-like, I guess.
Sure. So I got the study under Ted Neal over here at Ball State, yeah. and one of the projects that he gave me a little bit of leeway on, I made this first version of this robot, and I got to use all the amazing kilns there where we're talking about a whole different process than what I do down at the studio. But that idea of using the malleability of clay to mimic another type of material was intriguing to me, and I've got to come back to that and explore that. But I took that as an intro class from Ted Neal and have been able to extrapolate from that. But yeah, it's a lot of trial and error of, okay, what mark makes it look like a rivet? What yeah. mark makes it look like a screw? What mark makes it look like a plate that's stuck on, or should it be lifted up? And then on top of all of that, then you also have the glazing aspect of it, of trying to figure out, okay, what mix should I use to make this look metallic or you know, beat up or,
yeah.
you know,
those rusty kinds of things. Right. Yeah, uh-huh.
So yeah, a lot of trial and error. And you know, again, it's always that next one. It's like, oh, I got to try that and that together, you know. So it's a lot of fun.
And you've got to be okay with failure, right?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah, there's some of the early robots that I look at and I go, "Oh, yeah, you're going to sit on the back of the shelf because that was a good attempt, but not what I was after."
No one will see you yes. again.
Yeah. I'm on the 15th one, so, you wow. know, the first few were a little rough, we'll say.
Well, we cannot wait to see them all. How many pieces are you creating, or are you planning on creating for the September exhibit?
I think we're shooting for a dozen, anywhere from 10 to 12 that will be on display at Gordy's. Mm-hmm. So,
and before we go, talk a little bit about kind of the breadth of classes that you offer and where people can get more information.
Sure. So, again, I'm the owner of Made Muncie Pottery. MadeMuncie.com. You can always sign up for our workshops, do a lesson, come in anytime for the walk-in part, which is any of the glazing. So our hours are listed, and yeah, come find us. For a long time, we were Muncie's best kept secret. We don't want to be a secret anymore. So we're there to help you create memories that last. And I think that's kind of what we're all about. With not only the workshops, the lessons, but also just coming in and glazing something that's going to go on your tree for Christmas, or a tile for a trivet, or a coffee mug that you're going to give to mom for Mother's Day. We'd love to help you create something unique.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Torin, for coming into the studio and telling us about what you're working on.
Yeah.
Appreciate it.
I appreciate you having me. Thank you so much.
It's time to check out opportunities for arts and culture awesomeness this weekend and beyond.
Ultimate Party Band Toy Factory will perform at Dickman Town Center in Anderson Friday, August 2nd, as part of the city's summer concert series. The free concert begins at 7:30 p.m. It's also First Friday in Anderson, so there will be lots of other things to see and do that night, including ARTS, A Reason to Shop, at the Anderson Museum of Art.
The Indiana State Fair is up and running in Indianapolis. Fair dates are August 2nd through August 18th, and it's closed on Mondays. There are a lot of great exhibits, concerts, including Three Dog Night, a Beatles tribute, and Gladys Night this weekend, and that delicious and oh-so-healthy fair food. Mm. Michelle, have you heard of the All-American Mary?
No. Is that new this year?
It is new this year, and if you can believe it, it is a Bloody Mary. Mm-hmm. Which has a series of garnishes that include, but are not limited to, fried mac and cheese, a cheeseburger slider, and a mini apple pie.
That is an entire meal, and I can't think of anything more all-American.
an entire meal in your Bloody Mary.
That's right.
You can find that and all the other information you need about the Indiana State Fair at indianastatefair.com.
Ooh, I'm hungry now. Jambox will perform Friday, August 2nd in Yorktown as part of its summer concert series. And Booze Hound Bluegrass will be at Belgian Horse Winery in Middletown, August 2nd. The Earth Tones are at Elm Street Brewing Company, August 2nd. And on August 8th, you can check out Liverpool Lads, a Beatles tribute, at Hudson Family Park in Portland, Indiana, presented by Arts Place.
I'm excited for this one. Minnetrista will be hosting one-by-one community portrait days, August 9th through August 11th. Bring along something dear to you, whether it's a cherished object, a cherished loved one, or simply yourself, and have your portrait captured by photographer Tom Sterkowitz. Each visitor will receive a copy of their portrait to take home, and a curated selection will be featured in Minnetrista's 2025 exhibition, Community Portraits. It's free and open to all.
You know, Jen, I did that the last time it came around.
I did not, and awesome. I'm going this year. I can't wait.
I loved it. And the photos, for those who haven't seen it, they're in black and white.
They're
and
gorgeous.
They really are.
Yeah.
He just does such an amazing job of capturing things that it's not just kind of your regular posed shot.
Right.
I mean, they're filled with a lot of emotion and fun. Great, great, great opportunity. Looking ahead to next weekend, the Muncie Three Trails music series continues August 10th with Joe Mullins and the Radio Ramblers. And be sure to listen to the podcast next week. I had an opportunity to chat with Joe about bluegrass and having fun with your clothes on and so much more.
Do you have an event Pop of Culture listeners need to know about? Well, tell us at indianapublicradio.org/popofculture.
Pop of Culture on IPR is made possible in part by the Indiana Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations, and by sustaining members of IPR. Become a member today at indianapublicradio.org.
And that's our show. This week was produced by Luke Jones, who's holding out for deep-fried caviar.
He's fancy.
Our show was hosted this week by me, Michelle Kinsey.
And me, Jen Blackmer. Pop of Culture is a production of Indiana Public Radio on the campus of Ball State University.